Huckabee, our engineers. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you to all of our new and renewing members during our winter membership drive. That makes KBOO one of the best community radio stations in the country. Thank you once again for being the best supporters a station could ever ask for.
When you live in a poor neighborhood, you're living in an area where you have to have poor schools. When you have poor schools, you have poor teachers. When you have poor teachers, you get a poor education. Poor education, you can only work on a poor paying job. And that poor paying job enables you to live again in a poor neighborhood. So it's a very vicious cycle.
On February 17th, from the grassroots, where we agitate for social change with music and commentary, we will focus on the life and legacy of Malcolm X. Join us on February 17th from 8 p.m. until 10 p.m. We will focus on the life and legacy of Malcolm X.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering locally roasted coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or facebook.com/Grendel's Coffee House.
What would you have instead?
This is it.
There comes a time.
Good morning, good morning. It is about 3 minutes after 8 o'clock in the morning, and you are joining us here on KBOO, your very own community station, KBOO Portland, and this is Positively Revolting. I'm Ani.
I'm Lynn.
And this morning we are here with you talking about recent actions of ICE, of deportations, and of harassment and intimidation in immigrant communities. And to help us with that discussion, we have joining us by phone Ramon Ramirez from Pecun. Good morning, Ramon.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. Thank you very much, Ramon, for joining us this morning. And we also have in studio with us Alberto Moreno, from the Oregon State Commission on Hispanic Affairs, the chair of that commission, in fact. Thank you very much, Alberto.
Thank you for having us. We're delighted to have this conversation with you this morning.
It's an important conversation to have, and
we're sorry we have to have it, but
yes, there it is. But let's look at what is happening. There's a lot that has been going on All right, we're 4 weeks into the new regime.
Is that all?
I know. It feels like half a life, and it's 4 weeks. And yet, what we're seeing And what Trump is saying is he's merely making good on some campaign promises, which, if we look at those campaign promises, frightening enough. So as we look forward into what we can expect, and we look at what's happened for this last 4 weeks, we can see that immediately, 1 week into the regime, the travel, so-called travel ban, from seven prohibiting people from seven countries entering the states, regardless of their status, regardless of whether they were permanent residents or visitors, or if they'd had asylum worked out, any of these things was immediately cut off in a way that was most confusing, that spread fear, that spread terror, that disrupted families, disrupted people from returning to work, and caused a lot of confusion. Well, that order has been stayed by the Ninth Circuit Court. But we see just 2 weeks later, the raids last week and arrests starting, I believe it was about Thursday or so last week, that happened across the country in coordinated actions that, and there has been a lot of interesting information that has come out about that. Just a lot of mixed information, a lot of people saying, well, no, we don't think it's happening, a lot of denial that it's happening, and yet we're seeing real people affected and immediately deported, families torn apart. And so I consider this a state of emergency in our communities. And I'm very thankful to Ramon and Alberto this morning for making time to join us and help to shed a little light on what has been happening and what we can do to stand together and resist this. So thank you both again for being here. I want to start out, Alberto, if you could look at last week and just maybe give an overview of what was going on here in Oregon and how it has affected communities here.
Annie, thank you. Our communities, as you say, are in a state of distress. Our children are having a hard time sleeping at night. We have a president, a commander-in-chief who has become our persecutor-in-chief of our communities. And our children are coming home from school worried that they may not find their parents there. They wake up in the morning and go to school in fear that when they come back, that their parents may not return to them. We have many immigrants who are afraid to go to work, who are afraid to continue to make economic contributions to the state. We are literally living in a state of fear.
Of terror, I would say.
Indeed. That's how many of our communities are experiencing what seems to be very targeted kind of action. If you think about it, the president has literally released an unmeasured, unfettered immigration force throughout the country. What's unfortunate is that they've lost sight of what they're meant to do, so that they're actually targeting our mothers. They are literally picking up victims of domestic violence in court, where mothers should feel safe to bring forward complaints that protect and preserve their safety. We've heard reports that they are deporting and arresting Dreamers. These are students who, under Obama, were granted a deferral of immigration action. And so this new administration has lost focus. They, at the very least, have lost any sense of compassion and dignity, and our community is worried.
And Ramon, in Woodburn, there's a case of a fellow who was arrested and is now in detention, who was just on his way to work last Thursday, a week ago. Mr. Loesa, can you talk about that story?
Mr. Loesa's got a
was arrested by ICE agents. And this comes on the heels of our police chief, Jim Ferris, police chief in Woodburn, publicly in many circles, like the Statesman Journal and the Woodburn Independent and the Plimpton news media, had said that he wasn't going to enforce immigration law, and he was very clear about why. Was because he was going to follow the letter of the law in the state of Oregon, which we're one of the only states in the U.S. that has a law that prohibits law enforcement agencies and now state agencies from enforcing and collaborating with ICE. We call them the Migra. So he was stopped early in the morning going to work, pulled over, asked for his identification, and they asked him if he was this individual. The individual that they were looking for happens to be a relative of his. And he says, no, here's my identification, and they arrested him anyway. It was clear that from talking to the family that he doesn't have a criminal record. He's been in the country 30 years. The last time he left the country was 22 years ago to bring his wife. He brought his wife 22 years ago, and then 20 years, their first child was born, who's a U.S. citizen. They have three U.S. citizen children. One's 20, one's 19, the other one's 10. The two older kids have graduated from Woodburn High School. One of them attends community college. And so they're well known in the community. You have, you know, two of their kids, and they have also the 10-year-old attends school is also ill. He has a chronic medical condition. So immediately, as soon as he was arrested, no criminal record, they should have let him go. I mean, he has what we consider equity in the community. He has roots in the community. He has three U.S. citizen kids. He's been here 30 years. His daughter, who will turn 21 next year, is eligible to petition for her parents, both the father and the mother, to become legal permanent residents. With all this information, they still decided to arrest him. And so it's immediately after he was arrested, was sent to Portland and then shipped to Tacoma, which is a private prison run by a private profit-making company up in Tacoma, Washington, that that the U.S. government has awarded them to run this prison. And that's what it is. It's a prison. And so these are the people, anybody that's detained by ICE are sent to this prison in Tacoma, Washington. And that's what happened to this individual. As soon as that happened, the community started mobilizing a number of people. A number of the high school kids started a GoFundMe page. In fact, if people want to donate, there's a GoFundMe page. Help. It's called GoFundMe/HelpTheLuisa Family, and then you can donate. So far, I believe it's over $9,000 that they've raised in just a matter of a week. This happened a week ago. You know, the community's pretty upset. And like Alberto was saying, our families are living in a state of terror. He's absolutely correct when he states that kids don't want to go to school. There's a lot of fear. Elderly don't want to go to the doctor or the clinics. I know of a case of a woman that that called, and there was rumors that the that ICE was awaiting people in front of the clinic, the local farm worker clinic here. So she called to confirm if that was true or not, and she decided she wasn't going to go to her appointment. It's creating the very fabric that holds our community together. You know, it's a very diverse community that, you know, that it's a community that represents all sectors of Latinos, from Afro American, Afro Latinos, to indigenous folks. I've personally work and live in a community that has 16 different indigenous folks from Mexico and Latin America and Central America. Everybody's being affected by this. And so the rumors in the community that ICE has a roadblock in North Portland or in Woodburn, they're in the shopping malls, they're in the clinics. The recent rumor that ran last night here was that ICE was going to be at all the banks in Woodburn waiting for people to cash their checks so that they could deport them. So, I mean, when you have a community that's operating on that basis, you know, I spoke to a synagogue not too long ago, maybe about 5 years ago, and I sat by and I gave a presentation to the synagogue. And had, so people were walking out. An elderly couple stopped me and said, "We want to talk to you, young man." And they were victims of the Holocaust, and they survived it. And they said, you know, one day in America, the same thing that happened to us is going to happen to you. So, you know, start preparing for it, right? And that day has come. Mm-hmm. You know, we live. This is Nazi Germany is repeating itself again, and I'm not afraid to say that we live in a state of fascism, and that the officials that are now in control, for example, of Department of Homeland Security and the Attorney General, especially the Attorney General of the United States, Jeff Sessions. I've had the opportunity of meeting him and visiting him, his offices, many, many times while he was a senator in the U.S. Congress. And I'll tell you, this is one of the most racist, anti-immigrant persons in the world. The Southern Poverty Law Project considers him to be a neo-Nazi. And this is a guy he's the top law enforcement official running our country. And this guy told me one time that his solution to the immigration problem was lining up the U.S. military, the U.S. Army, with orders to shoot anybody crossing the border, and we would solve our immigration problem instantly. And now he's running the country. I mean, you know, that's the kind of people that we have. He's not only targeting immigrants, but he's targeting people of color. You know, he was really, he orchestrated a lot of efforts to suppress voters, you know, people of color voters, especially in his own state of Alabama. You know, some of the most mean-spirited laws that we have in terms of immigration, worse than Arizona's laws in terms of immigration.
And you hardly ever think you can say that.
Yeah, it's...
But you can.
That's right. So, you know, it's a horrible situation that we're in. And every corner and every community throughout the states, and, you know, Alberto, as chair of the Hispanic Commission, he knows this. He's visited all these communities. That in every community, we have the same situation of fear and terror in our community. And, you know, I'm really happy to see that there's that Oregonians are coming out in flocks to support us. They've come out to the demonstrations, to the marches, to the protests. They've been calling us, and, you know, these are people that want to participate and want to help out the immigrant community. And rightfully so, because I truly believe an attack on us is an attack on all of us.
Absolutely. So, Ramona and Alberto, when this first started happening, everybody was talking about sanctuary cities. And a lot of people were breathing a sigh of relief. Oh, there'll be sanctuary. But what did, to the two of you, what does that mean?
Good question. I have the honor of standing with Governor Brown when she signed her executive order declaring Oregon a sanctuary state. And we're so proud of her. And we believe that those are the right kind of values at the highest level of government in Oregon. But there's the practical question. What does that really mean?
That's what I'm talking about.
Sure. And Governor Brown is limited in what she's able to do. And so the executive order does a few things. One, it says that no state monies can or shall be used to aid and abet this ICE immigration force that the president has marshaled against our communities. It means that the state will not collaborate with immigration enforcement action, which, by the way, just to be clear with folks, is a federal function. It is not a state function. It is appropriately a federal function. And then the third thing, as I recall, the executive order refuses to cooperate with a Muslim registry of any kind. And so these are the three effective steps that Governor Kate Brown has taken. But it doesn't protect us fully.
Right.
We have heard, as you know, reports that ICE agents are literally invading the halls of our court systems of Multnomah County. And these are not rumors. These were confirmed events where ICE agents were literally waiting outside of courtrooms to detain folks who were there for a simple traffic violation. And so Ramon is absolutely right. The intended effect of this is really to have a chilling effect on our community. They mean to terrorize our community so that we don't vote, so that we don't participate civically, so that we don't demonstrate our displeasure. It is a very intentional way of having a chilling effect in silencing our community.
I want to go ahead and open up the phone lines to listeners who have questions or comments, concerns themselves. Please do give us a call. Join in the conversation at 503-231-8187. That's 503-231-8187. You are listening to KBOO, your community radio station. This is Positively Revolting. I'm Ani.
I'm Lynn.
And we have with us by phone Ramon Ramirez from Pecun. And we have in studio Alberto Moreno from the Oregon State Commission on Hispanic Affairs. And we thank you both again for joining us. Also, listeners, if you want to follow along throughout the week, please do follow us in social media. You can find our page on Facebook, Positively Revolting, or in the Twitterverse, we are at Positive Revolt. And I also want people to know that we are posting resources to the Facebook page. You can find the GoFundMe page for the Loaysa family there, as well as other resources for communities in distress. So, right, let's, I want to sort of maybe backtrack just for a moment and look at what has been happening previous to the new regime. Because we know that before the Dreamers Act was passed, in between 2009 and 2015, the Obama administration actually had the record for the number of deportations. And so there has been some groundwork laid by the previous administration that happened fairly much outside the notice of people outside of immigrant communities. Certainly people who were being targeted at the time noticed. But for those of us who are not in immigrant communities, people there's a lot going on in the world, and they didn't seem to notice that so much. I've had some interesting conversations over the last week where I've mentioned this to people, and they're standing there open mouthed and in disbelief. Alberto, can you talk about what was happening previous to the DREAM Act, and then how that is affecting the stage today?
Sure. We certainly were fond of President Obama. He did some good things for our community, but unfortunately, he was also very effective in deporting our community. There are some estimates that he was able to deport during his administration anywhere from 2 to 3 million individuals from the U.S. And so his mechanism was highly effective. It didn't have the same feel as what we're seeing and experiencing now, to be fair and to be honest, but it is important to note that indeed he was very effective, and some folks accurately record that he deported a record number of individuals.
And when you say that it has a different feel, I absolutely understand that. Can you elaborate on that a little bit? You know, to some people's minds, well, deportation is deportation. But in the last couple of weeks, the fear and urgency just really has sharply risen.
It has. I think much of it has to do with the unfortunate vernacular being used by our forefather. By our most preeminent forefather in this country, which is arguably the president of the United States. Unfortunately, his rhetoric and his verbiage is highly offensive, highly inaccurate, and seems to be sourced in a place of deep insecurity and fear. When you describe our hardworking folks as rapists, and criminals and drug dealers
and bad hombres.
Aside from the cartoonish language and the inaccuracy of it, it is just so unfortunate. And so it really feels that we as a community are being targeted by an uninformed precedent, by a precedent who's giving in to the basest of emotions, which are fear and hate. And that's not what we need from a precedent. We expect a precedent to rise above that. You know, some people say, well, deporting folks who are here legally makes sense. That's what the law is, and we are a nation of laws. But I want to remind people that legality is not our highest standard bearer. Right? It used to be legal to bar people from interracial backgrounds to marry. Slavery used to be legal. Discrimination on the basis of race used to be legal. Mm-hmm. And so we need to rise above this idea that because something is legal, that it's just. Right? Our highest standard here is, what is the humane thing to do? What does justice dictate? Legality is a question made up of smaller minds. And it can change at the discretion. This is what Ramon is hinting at. We know that immigration rules are 90% administrative, which is to say that whoever is in charge of that office, who's ever in charge of the Department of Homeland Security, can say what the operating rules are, which means that this person can set aside due process for our communities, right? Can say to folks, we suspect that you're here illegally, and all we need is suspicion, and all we need is two ICE agents to affirm that might be true, and we can arrest you, send you to a for-profit detention prison whose profits are predicated on keeping you there as long as possible, which creates conflicts of interest because they have no financial interest to allow you to make a call to an attorney, to facilitate your own representation, to provide you access to legal counsel, to provide you with meals and phone calls that don't cost $24 a minute. So we invite our white allies to ask deeper questions, to go beyond the sound bites of hate and fear.
Absolutely. We have callers. So, Deanna?
Good morning.
You're on the air.
Thank you. Thank you for having this very painful conversation. My friends and I have been to every rally. We've gone to the churches to prepare for sanctuary, and now hearing you speak about the limits of law, and particularly the fact that Jeff Sessions is in charge of this administration of the Department of Justice, it seems clear to me that the law cannot really sufficiently help us now. And you may not be able to legitimately comment on this on the air, but I'm going to say it because no one's stopping me right now. You know, in the 60s, the Black Panthers armed themselves. And I'm thinking that what some of us who are not liable to be deported, because we are not people who have recently come to this country, people who've been here for 100 years or so, our families, we need to stand in front of that courthouse armed, and we need to prevent ICE from going into the courthouse. You may not be able to comment on this, but if not, I'd like to know what is your ask, what is the call that we can further do in our communities to participate in this?
Thank you so much for that question and for your thoughtfulness and for your offer of assistance. You know, we had an incident a couple weeks back where Latino parishioners on a Sunday were making their way to church for the simple purpose of worship. And their experience that Sunday morning is that there were 10 or 12 angry white men who started to yell racial slurs and statements about go back to where you came from, et cetera, et cetera. And as disheartening as that was for our community, as much as they may have lost faith in that moment, what happened the following Sunday, I can tell you because I was there, was an example of how our allies can stand with us. And let me describe to you what happened the following week. The following Sunday, the same parishioners showed up again with the same intent to kneel and to worship to their God. But this time, there were about 300 white allies who showed up with their simple presence to tender their bodies and say, "We are here to protect you. We are here to lay down our bodies without force, to make sure that you can worship in peace." That is the kind of action, that is the kind of non-violent resistance that we need in our country. It is a resistance sourced from love, not hate or fear. And that is the kind of brotherhood and sisterhood that we long for as a community.
And thank you so much.
Ramon, do you have anything to add to how allies can provide support?
Yeah, I truly believe that at this point, you know, nonviolent action is our best defense. And also it's our best it's the best expression that we could give to the immigrant community right now. And Alberto's explanation of the act of solidarity that happened at St. Peter's, San Pedro's church is a good example of that, where you had people from all walks of life, from all religions, came and stood there with the immigrant community. I was also privileged to get invited to attend a workshop led by the Portland Immigrant Rights Coalition up in San Agustana's Lutheran Church, where more than 500 people attended. And there was more Anglo white people than Latinos there, which I happened to be with a couple of Latinos there that I went with because we were going to another meeting, and we stopped by. And I could tell you that those immigrants were really happy, and they were really amazed at having white folk there, you know, protecting them or interested in being part of a rape resistance movement, right? So part of what we're trying to do in the community is develop a rape resistance network where all people can participate, right? And so, and how that works is that we protect our community, anybody that they can, right? The pretext is that that they're going after criminals. They're They're not going after, they're going after everybody. We just had a member of ours, and I'll just speak to it. I can't give all the information because this has just happened last night. But one of our elderly members, she's an elderly woman. She's from the Purépecha tribe in the state of Michoacán. We have a big Purépecha community, which is an indigenous community in Woodburn, went to Mexico, was on her way back. So she left in November. So clearly she didn't overstay her visa because, you know, if you stay 6 months out of the country, they have the right to take away your permanent residency. Mm-hmm. She clearly wasn't a criminal, clearly wasn't overstayed her permanent resident visa. And she was forced to sign a form called 407, where she gave up her right to be a permanent resident. And this is what's happening in addition to the raids and to all the things that are happening to the immigrant community, is that they're going after legal permanent residents. This woman, she doesn't even speak Spanish that well. She was told, sign this paper, or else we're gonna take away your green card. And so she signed, and they took away her green card, and they deported her. She basically self-deported herself to Mexico. She wasn't allowed to cross, right? That's what this government is doing right now, right? So it's full of baloney that they're saying that we're going after criminals. No, we're starting to see the beginnings of an onslaught of immigrants. When Trump said in his campaign that he's going to deport, you know, he's going to try to deport the 11 million, that's what we're seeing. We're starting to see the mechanism set up, the infrastructure, you know, and the funding for it, right? And through his executive orders, right? He's trying to criminalize even legal residents so that, you know, so there's a bigger question here. You know, why is the U.S. government attacking immigrants in this manner, right? What's all behind this?
Yes.
And so I think that's another question, right, that deserves another conversation. But, you know, it definitely has to do with the fact that I believe that when you talk to the people like Oregonians for Immigration Reform, which is the anti-immigrant group here in the state, right, when they talk to you about immigration, they only talk about for 1 minute about immigration, you know. But what they are talking about is saying, you know, we don't want immigrants here. We want the America of before.
And what the heck is that? You know, I keep wondering, exactly?
There was a question by a reporter, and this is on Channel 2 News, that they were doing a rally against Measure 88. And they said, well, you know, your banner's a little bit racist, you know. And the people that were protesting said, sure. Yeah, we want Oregon to be like it was before. And, you know, one would think, well, you know, to be like Native American.
Yeah, that's what I think.
And they said, no, we want it the way it was to be white people.
Right.
And so that's to me, that, I mean, when they mentioned that, right, that, because we've been getting that when we confront these people, right, you know, it's nativism at its highest form, right? And what they're...
Or lowest form.
That's very good.
Thank you.
I think that that it's that's the crux of the matter here. Let's be real. This is what, you know, the fear that in, you know, in just 20 or 30 years from now, the majority of people that will live in America will be people of color, right? And so they're fearing that. And I think that's what's behind all this, right? And so I'm starting to ask questions around to our own community and to when I'm invited to speak with people, I ask the question to people, yeah, sure, you know, we'll become the majority in 2040. You know, supposedly, I think it's even before that. But, you know, but my question is that what kind of society are we going to want to build, right? And so the people that are involved in human rights issues and in human dignity issues in the civil rights movement, the immigrant rights movement, and the movement for economic and social and gender justice, we all have to start working on what kind of society we're going to build when people of color are the majority. Are we going to build a society built on status quo? Or are we going to build a society based on respect and dignity for all? Will we build a country where we honor diversity and culture and we bring in people into our house? Everybody, right, comes into our house, right? Is that the kind of society we want? Or are we going to let the fascists and the racists and the homophobics and people like that control our country?
No, I say.
That is the question. That is it. I want to remind people you are listening to KABU, your community radio station. This is Positively Revolting. Our guests this morning are Ramon Ramirez, who is on by phone. He is working with PECUN in Woodburn. And we also have Alberto Moreno, who is the chair of Oregon's Commission on Hispanic Affairs. If you would like to join in this conversation, please do give us a call at 503-231-8187 503-231-8187.
Also, just like John did,
you can like us on Facebook. You can find us there, Positively Revolting. We do post links to resources that are pertinent to every show we do, as well as engage with you, you know, between shows, because once a week is not enough. And then on Twitter, you can find us at Positive Revolt. Yes, Lynn, you're absolutely right. John has joined us. Good morning, John. You're on the air.
Well, here's a classic example of ignorance of history. I remember seeing some things in Great Britain when they had problems with their immigration problems. But, however, they had some the people who were protesting about Great Britain's government. They had a great battle cry. We are here because you were there. And it's not so much as a, you know, WASP America being in Mexico or Guatemala or where the, you know, whatever you want to call it. But, you know, when you occupy a country's problems, their problems become your problems. And what I'm talking about is like NAFTA, CAFTA. And, you know, and people don't understand that one-third of Mexico was taken away from them in 1846 to 1848. So, you know, the United States goes around kicking other people's asses, and they're not understanding that their ass becomes our ass. And if you go to, like, Philadelphia, Boston, or New York, how come you don't see illegal Irish people getting deported? You know, this is just a blatant, you know, melon of the skin. And thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, John, for your call. Alberto, you want to address that?
Thank you. I really appreciate the caller and his deeper understanding of a fuller history of this nation and how it became America, right? This notion that we found this empty land that nobody was using, the fallacy of that, the fact that these are the ancestral lands of Native Americans who called this home before immigrants from Europe arrived unbidden on this continent. But I want to talk about Oregon. I want to talk about who we're talking about, which is to say undocumented workers. And just some basic facts of folks know, because these don't generally make the light of day. But it's estimated, according to the Oregon Center for Public Policy, a nonpartisan independent organization, that there are between 110,000 to 220,000 undocumented individuals working in Oregon. The average is said to be about 150,000 undocumented individuals in Oregon. They earn between $2.3 billion to $4.5 billion annually through the labor of their work. I want to emphasize the part about earning, right? Because a job is not something you steal. A job is something you work that there. I thought I'd emphasize that. Additionally, the accusation is always made, well, these people are a burden on our tax system, on our services. I want to point out, beyond refute, that it is estimated that these undocumented individuals pay over $309 million in taxes each and every year to the state of Oregon alone. And so we need to be mindful. We need to better understand what our contributions are. And the fact that the reason we're here is because we've been invited to be here to do a work, a body of work that other folks don't want to do. When Trump's Americans talk about making America great, it's lovely rhetoric, I'm sure, in that echo chamber. But it's actually immigrants who are building America's roads.
And it's, always have.
And always have. It's immigrants who are remodeling your houses. It's immigrants who are picking our fruits and our vegetables. And so while Trump's America talks about making America great, we are actually, through our work and through our sweat, doing the work of making America great.
Absolutely. And, you know, I saw an article about a farmer in Alabama whose tomato crop rotted because all the folks who were going to, pick them, split because they were afraid of being deported. And apparently all the European folks didn't come lining up for that job. I don't know exactly what happened. The jobs that people were being stolen were all ready for them, and they were nowhere to be found. So,
I wanted to address a question.
Please do.
I want to thank Alberto for reminding us that reminding the public that immigrants do contribute to paying our fair share of taxes. We not only pay our fair share of taxes, but we also create jobs just in farm labor, for example, because I'm the president of the Farm Worker Union. You know, our folks pick the crops, but we generate jobs. We don't take away jobs because those fruits and vegetables that we pick. And, you know, the American people should be honored that immigrant workers come and they risk their lives crossing the border. You know, we have seven of our members currently lost in the border on the U.S.-Mexican border in Arizona that we haven't found since 2007. But my point is people are literally dying to come across to work in jobs that people don't want to do. They work in farm labor. They pick the fruits and vegetables. They create jobs because those fruits and vegetables have to be washed. They have to be processed, creating jobs. They have to be canned, creating jobs. They have to be transported to the retailers that are creating jobs. And then we have to, you know, we sell them in the supermarkets, right, that creating jobs. So we don't take away jobs from U.S. citizens. We're actually creating jobs. My point that the gentleman that called raised was a very important, you know, the thing about CAFTA and NAFTA, right, are two free trade agreements
are the opposite of free.
Right. I know this because I sat, I was on the Secretary of Labor's committee on the labor provisions. You know, enforcing the labor provisions of both CAFTA and the agreement that we have with Canada and Mexico to make sure that the labor provisions were respected, right? In fact, we were the ones that initiated a lawsuit against Guatemala for violating CAFTA for not paying minimum wage and child labor laws. But my point here is that immigration or those free trade agreements, right? Our economic policies, the U.S. economic policies towards our neighbors to the south, are actually the biggest creators of illegal immigration in history. And the reason being is because, you know, our economic policies, we look to our neighbors in the south as a way to exploit their natural resources, as a way to do away with their laws to protect their internal development and their internal economic development, do away with them, right, by buying off elections and so forth, so that we can introduce, those countries can introduce more more foreign investment. And we have, like in the case of Mexico, where now Mexico imports almost all its basic staple foods, beans, rice, flour, corn, soy, milk, and so forth, right? And the reason why the Mexican government, which is the largest buyers of these products, are buying those, because they're not buying locally no more. In part because they're a lot cheaper on the market. They're a lot cheaper. U.S. products are a lot cheaper because our U.S. government is subsidizing the growers to sell them cheaper. Mm-hmm. And so a poor farm worker, a small grower in Mexico cannot compete with U.S. products. Because their biggest buyer, which was the government, and that runs on many institutions, including the military and education and so forth, are buying from the U.S. So a lot of these small growers are having to give up their farms and cross the border as undocumented workers and working in farms. I remember attending a forum in both in Mexico and the U.S., but the one in Mexico was in particular interest, was that the small farmers had at a forum that was in Cancun prior to the start of the agricultural discussions on the World Trade Organization's formulation of ag agreements, right? We heard a delegation from the state of Zacatecas say that they had grown the largest pinto bean production in history. And everybody started yelling, yay, you know. But then they said, well, we haven't sold last year's. And in part, we haven't sold last year's. And we're not going to sell this year's bumper crop that we have, because our government that used to buy our crops are buying from the U.S., from the U.S. growers, because they're being subsidized by their government. So who's creating illegal immigration here, right? And this is a fact that many people in the U.S. don't realize. Our own government is creating illegal immigration into this country.
Yeah, I think it's super important for people to understand that, by and large, folks don't choose to leave the culture, communities, and families they are raised in. That tends to be driven by economic realities. And that tends to drive economic realities, and war are the two biggest factors in immigration worldwide. And so if we want to actually look at, for whatever reason, you know, not having immigration, then we really want to look at how our country, our government, is playing into conditions by creating harsh economic realities, devastating economic realities, and war, that people obviously and for good cause need to flee. You know, it makes sense. It's a big picture view. And we are almost out of time. We have a caller on hold. I want to make sure that we also talk about some upcoming actions that are taking place over the next couple of weeks. So let's go ahead and sneak Sunny in real quick right here. Good morning, Sunny. You're on the air.
Yes, I'll try to be brief, but I wish to bring up a matter that is equally or even more so important to all of us for our freedom and our safety. Woodburn Catholic Church recently, the priest of the church was on the news because that church was broken into, vandalized, $10,000 worth of damage. Chalices that hold the wine were broken, and also the closet that they keep the information for the people that are seeking refuge, shelter, hope, help from them was also broken into, like perhaps people were going to grab those files of information on the people that they're trying to help. I'm going to bring this to the point. I'm an American Indian. Our people have suffered very hard up here in the North from time to time, from both Christians who've gotten crazy from time to time, and Satanists. Look up the Tolowa massacre. The fact of the matter is there are satanic gangs in Mexico who are terrorizing, persecuting people who are fleeing up here. There are disappearances, and this is occurring in America amongst some of our own American citizens of all colors, from satanic church fires, vandalism,
all right.
Terrorizing. We must
Sunny,
stand
we are
together
just about out of time.
Kind of thing.
But I thank you very much for your call. And it's I did want to talk about the church that was vandalized. As we have seen actually across the country, other acts of vandalism in very targeted ways in the communities under attack. Alberto, do you want to comment at all on the church or Ramon?
Thank you. I don't know that I agree with everything that the caller talked about, but I wanna agree with the idea that grace and hope are greater than fear and hate. And so what I actually want to do is I want to call upon our allies, our brothers and sisters, to find this church and to make that church whole, to find some way of contributing to restoring the sanctuary of that sacred place by either making a donation, by showing up to volunteer to help, by supporting the parishioners who suffered this violation, because at the end of the day, we need to demonstrate and prove what I believe is true, which is that hope and kindness are greater than fear and hate. And I think we have an opportunity here to do that.
Thank you. So we have, I know of three actions that are coming right up. One of them is actually today. You know, this is February 17th. It was a day that was called for a general strike, if folks can do that. And one action that has come about is at 1 o'clock today, folks involved in the legal community are going to be at the outside of the Multnomah County Justice Center, and this is being co-sponsored by the Center for Constitutional Rights and sponsored by the National Lawyers Guild, co-sponsored by a host of others. Again, we will post details of this on our Facebook page as we are almost out of time, and I don't have time to read them all to you right now, but that's today, 1 to 2 o'clock, the legal community strikes back, meeting outside of the Multnomah County Courthouse. On Sunday, there is a rally and march in Salem at the Oregon State Capitol. And that is part of a nationwide action, I believe.
I'm actually attending that rally on Monday. It starts at noon, and it's basically we want to send a message to the Oregon that, you know, Trump's not our president. But I want to say that for those that are coming to Oregon, it's really important that if you're going to the rally, that there's a hearing on a bill that Alberto's group is leading called Cover All Kids. Can you talk about that hearing that starts at 1, right after that rally?
Yes, thank you, Ramon. So my organization, the Oregon Latino Health Coalition, is trying to make sure that all children in Oregon have access to healthcare, vital healthcare services. And we've introduced a bill which has a hearing on Monday at 1 o'clock. And the intent of that bill is to make sure that all children have access to the vital healthcare services that they need. And so if you want to join us in support of that, we would welcome you joining us. The basic notion is the idea, the value that I think holds true in Oregon is that all of our children should be protected, that all of our children should be taken care of. And right now, about 20,000 children are excluded from Oregon's grace. They literally do not meet the legal definition of child, which is to say that our immigrant children are not thought of as human beings, and we want to help to correct that gross oversight.
The information I have say I've seen that the immigrants' march is on Sunday, and I'm hearing it's on Monday. Can we clarify that? Do you know?
That's on Monday.
It's on Monday. Monday.
Yeah, on
Monday at noon at the state capitol.
Yeah, and then at 1 o'clock is the hearing, so we're going to be asking people that to attend the the rally at the state capitol on Monday, that they can go over to, you know what hearing room that is, Alberto?
I believe it's hearing room E.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. And again, we will try to post all of this information on our Facebook page. You can find it, Positively Revolting, on Facebook. And then the last rally I know about is on February 28th, and that's here in Portland at Terry Schrunk Plaza at 5 o'clock Tuesday, February 28th. Latinx rally defending the DREAM Act, announcing state and capital, state and city demands. And so with that, we are completely out of time. I really do want to thank very much Alberto Moreno and Ramon Ramirez for joining us this morning for this discussion.
Thank you so much.
Thank you both for your work.
And please do check out the Positively Revolting Facebook page for links to resources and actions coming up. We'll be back next week with oh so much more.
There comes a time.
Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. This month, because of the membership drive, the Program Advisory Committee will meet Tuesday, February 21st at 6 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Seed to Table Supper Event to benefit Cully Community Clinic on Saturday, February 25th at 5 p.m. at the Side Yard Farm and Kitchen in Portland. Chef Stacy Givens will host a seat-to-table dinner array with herbal cocktails and wine. This supper event will support Seasonal Wellness Clinic and the rehabilitation of its trailer and to stock the clinic with supplies. Again, that's the seat-to-table supper event to benefit Cully Community Clinic on Saturday, February 25th at 5 p.m. at the Side Yard Farm and Kitchen.